The whole head freak boho slug mob stares at him, all these lollipop eyes, as if he is going to produce the Beatles from out of a sleeve. Then they start grumbling, like a bunch of prisoners who haven't been fed, but don't know whether this is the time for the slave revolt or not. It is a debacle, except that it is so damned comical. The look on their faces. That, and the appearance of Owsley. A cocky little guy, short with dark hair, dressed like an acid head, the usual boho gear, but with a strange wound-up nasal voice like a head with the instincts of a roller-skating rink promoter, this little character materializes in front of Kesey from out of the boho slug multitudes and announces, "I'm Owsley." Kesey doesn't say, "Hi, I'm Kesey." He just looks at him as if to say, "All right, you're Owsley and you're here. And then what?" Owsley looks stunned. "I'm Owsley." In fact, Kesey never heard of him. It was like if Owsley suddenly found himself in a place where nobody ever heard of him, he didn't know what to do. He and Kesey are just standing there trading eyeballs until finally Owsley produces a little bag he has and opens it, and it is full of capsules of acid. He's Owsley, the greatest LSD manufacturer in the world, which turns out to be just about right, the Sandoz Chemical Corporation included. Mountain Girl looks and just smiles. Everything gets funnier and funnier on the Beetle Patrol. He's got his little bag of acid. Mountain Girl figures him for a wiseacre right away. Kesey looks at the bag full of acid. One thing the little wiseacre's got is acid. The world's greatest acid manufacturer, bar none, standing out in the dark in the middle of nowhere, amid the boho slug multitudes under the shadowy redwoods. By and by, they had most of the boho slugs off the place and sliding up the highway in the dark, looking for Christ knows what, seeing as how the Beatles never made it. Kesey and Owsley and the pranksters sat down around a fire out by the big stump. And who the hell shows up but the mad chemist? He and Owsley start sniffing and eyeing each other. It's like the slick, sharp, young neurological doctor genius from out of the Mayo Clinic face to face with the old, blousy, homey country doctor on the most puzzling and difficult case in the history of medicine. Owsley and the mad chemist start arguing over drugs. It's like a debate. All the pranksters, even Kesey, keep out of it, and the two of them start hammering away. "Let the little wiseacre have it, mad chemist," Mountain Girl keeps thinking, and most of the pranksters feel the same way. But Owsley, the little wiseacre, is tearing him up. Owsley is young and sharp and quick, and the mad chemist is an old man, and he has taken too much dope. He's loose in the head. He tries to argue, and his brains all run together like goo. Owsley, the pranksters figure, well, maybe he never even took acid himself. Or maybe he took it once. It is just something they sense. And the poor old mad chemist, he has taken so much dope, caressing his gums and hooking down dope, he is loose in the head, and Owsley just tears him up. The mad chemist is getting crushed. The mad chemist never came around again, but once or twice it was all so humiliating. So the pranksters had this little wiseacre Owsley on their hands, whether they liked it or not. But he did make righteous acid, and he had money. Between the two of them, Owsley and the pranksters, they were about to put LSD all over the face of the globe. Little by little, Owsley's history seeped out. He was 30 years old, although he looked younger, and he had a huge, sonorous name, Augustus Owsley Stanley III. His grandfather was a United States Senator from Kentucky. Owsley apparently had had a somewhat hung-up time as a boy, going from prep school and then to a public high school, dropping out of that, but getting into the University of Virginia School of Engineering, apparently because of his flair for sciences, then dropping out of that. He finally wound up enrolling in the University of California in Berkeley, where he hooked up with a hip, good-looking chemistry major named Melissa. They dropped out of the university, and Owsley set up his first acid factory at 1647 Virginia Street, Berkeley. He was doing a huge business when he got raided on February 21, 1965. He got off, however, because there was no law against making, taking, or having LSD in California until October 1966. He moved his operation to Los Angeles, 2205 Lafler Road, called himself the Bayer Research Group, and paid out $20,000 in $100 bills to the Cycle Chemical Corporation for 500 grams of lysergic acid monohydrate, the basic material in LSD, which he could convert into 1.5 million doses of LSD at from $1 to $2 apiece wholesale. He bought another 300 grams from International Chemical and Nuclear Corporation. His first big shipment arrived March 30, 1965. He had a flair, this Owsley. By and by, he had turned out several million doses of LSD in capsules and tablets. They had various whimsical emblems on them to indicate the strength. The most famous among the heads were the Owsley Blues, with a picture of Batman on them, 500 micrograms worth of superhero inside your skull. The heads wrapped over Owsley Blues like old juice heads drawling over that famous one-time brand from Owsley's Virginia home territory, Fairfax County Bourbon, bottled in bond. "Owsley makes righteous acid," said the heads. Personally, he wasn't winning any popularity contests with the heads or the cops either. He is, like, arrogant. He is a wiseacre. But the arrogant little wiseacre makes righteous acid. In fact, Owsley's acid was famous internationally. When the acid scene spread to England in late 1966 and 1967, the hippest intelligence one could pass around was that one was in possession of Owsley acid. In the acid world, this was bottled in bond, certified, guaranteed, and high status. It was in this head world that the Beatles first took LSD. Now, just to get ahead of the story a bit, after Owsley hooked up with Kesey and the Pranksters, he began backing a musical group called the Grateful Dead. Through the Dead's experience with the Pranksters was born the sound known as acid rock. And it was that sound that the Beatles picked up on after they started taking acid to do a famous series of acid rock record albums, Revolver, Rubber Soul, and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Early in 1967, the Beatles got a fabulous idea. They got hold of a huge school bus and piled into it with 39 friends and drove and wove across the British countryside, zonked out of their gourds. They were going to make a movie. Not an ordinary movie, but a totally spontaneous movie, using handheld cameras, shooting the experience as it happened, off the top of the head, cavorting, rapping on, soaring in the moment, visionary chaos, a daydream, a black art, a chaos. They finished up with miles and miles of film, a monster, a veritable morass of it, all shaky and out of focus, blissful zonk, which they saw as a total breakthrough in terms of expression, but also as a commercial display, shown on British TV it was, that might be appreciated even outside the esoteric world of the heads. The movie, called Magical Mystery Tour. And the great banner rippled on the Prankster Gate in the nighttime in ripples and intergalactic billows of great howling Owsley electro-mad chemical synchronicity. The Merry Pranksters welcome the Beatles.
Chapter 16. The Frozen Jug Band. Synchronicity spoken here. And the Pranksters sit around Kesey's living room at night, grooving on many strange events. Like the day of the great blackout in New York City, the great power failure that knocked out subways, elevators, lights, air conditioners, TVs, clocks, buildings, and the rest of the hulks in the great cancer capital of the East. The Pranksters grooved over the cataclysm and grokked it. Such consternation in the cancer capital. A huge surge of electricity had suddenly rolled through the wires and freaking blown everything. The utility companies didn't know what had caused this surge, but by God they had experts working on it and they would figure it out and such a surge would never occur again. A surge, Mahavira? Meanwhile, there was one story in the newspapers that the Pranksters grooved on most truly. It seems that some kid had been playing hooky from school in New York that day, and had gone off to the movies finally, and come out of the movie house about 5:15 p.m. and started walking home, feeling guilty already. And he picked up a stick out of the gutter and he started whacking parking meters with it. When he got to the corner, he whacked the big utility pole there, and in that very moment, all the lights in New York went out. Now. And the kid ran home in the dark, crying, confessing all to his mother. I did it, but I didn't mean to. And Kesey and the Pranksters did groove on that. The kid was right, that was the funny part. Or at least as right as the utility companies. For no doubt, there was a great surge, friends, and it came through that kid just like it came through everything and every being that existed in that moment. Just as Severn Darden blew out the candles on his birthday cake in that very moment, and they poked through every Con Ed transformer in the system, and they never did find the cause. Cosmo. And once you find out about Cosmo, you know he's running the show. It's like we're strands of wire intertwined in a great cable that runs through a slot. The pranksters, the Beatles, the Vietnam Day Committee. The Vietnam Day Committee. Running through a slot, and all the wires are vibrated by Cosmo. Most people lead two-dimensional lives. All they can see is the face of the slot, a cross-section, so that the wires look like a mass of separate little circles looking bigger or smaller according to how close you are. They can't see that these circles are just cross-sections of wires that run backward and forward infinitely, and that there is a great surge through the whole cable, and that anybody who is truly into the full bare essence of the thing... There is food in the ting. My comrades are envious, but they cannot harm me. Good fortune. The I Ching. Tends to react against political disorder because he is concerned with the deep basic religious experience, the deepest sources of life. Transient politics are insignificant to him. Joachim Vuk. It was against this backdrop, namely the ultimate and the infinite, that an organization known as the Vietnam Day Committee invited Kesey to come speak at a huge anti-war rally in Berkeley on the University of California campus. I couldn't tell you what Bright Fellow thought of that, inviting Kesey. Afterwards, they didn't know either. Or at least none of them would own up, despite a lot of interrogations and recriminations and general thrashing about. Who the hell invited this bastard, was the exact wording. A regular little rhubarb they had for themselves. The main trouble with the Vietnam Day Committee was that they couldn't see beyond the marvelous political whoopee they had cooked up. Why should they? From where they were looking in the fall of 1965, they were about to sweep the country. Berkeley, the New Left, the Free Speech Movement, Mario Savio, the Rebel Generation, the Student Revolution, in which students were going to take over the universities, like in Latin America, and drive some fire up the clammy rectum of American life. You could read about it in all the magazines, and if you don't believe it, come here and watch us, Mr. Jones, and so forth. They never looked beyond that, as I say, but it might have been no use in any case. Maybe there was no way in the world anybody could have made the Vietnam Day Committee realize how their whole beano looked to Kesey and the pranksters. Come rally against the war in Vietnam. From the cosmic vantage point the pranksters had reached, there were so many reasons why this little charade was pathetic they didn't know where to begin. Nevertheless, Kesey was invited, and that was how the fun started. Marchers were pouring into Berkeley from 71 cities and 28 states, for whatever such sums are worth. At any rate, thousands of students and professors from all over. There were to be teach-ins all day and also an all-day rally starting in the morning with 30 or 40 speakers to whip things up. And then at 7:30 in the evening, when the fever pitch was reached, they would all rise up off the Berkeley campus and march over into Oakland, 15 or 20,000 souls in a massive line, marching on the Oakland Army Terminal. The Oakland Army Terminal was where men and supplies were shipped out to Vietnam. Just to spice things up a bit, a large supply of gelignite had been stolen, and everybody had visions of Oakland, Berkeley, San Francisco, the whole clump, blowing up in a gelignite earthquake of cops, peaceniks, birchers, and probably spades and innocent women and children. Nobody had any idea which side had stolen the gelignite, but that only made it better. The gelignite scare seemed to give Kesey the inspiration for this prank. Kesey's saving grace was that he never got serious where he could say it just as well with a cosmic joke. Kesey's fantasy for the occasion was to come upon the huge anti-war rally as a freaking military invasion. It was a true inspiration, this fantasy. They were going to rig up the bus as a rolling fortress with guns sticking out, and all the pranksters would dress military. Then they would get cars and rig them up the same way, and at the head of the whole convoy, there would be the Hell's Angels in running formation, absolutely a dangle with swastikas. Swastikas! It would freaking blow their minds, or at least give their cool a test like it never had before. First, they painted the whole bus a dull red color, the color of dried blood, in fact. Right on over the greatest riot of day-glow design in history went this bloody muck. But who gave a damn? Art is not eternal. Then they started painting military symbols on the dried blood, swastikas, American eagles, iron crosses, Viking crosses, red crosses, hammers and sickles, skulls and bones, anything as long as it looked rank. That very night, naturally, the seasonal rains started, and like the chief said, art is not eternal. All the paint started running until it was the most dismal mess imaginable. Somehow that was appropriate. The next day, Gut and his girlfriend, Little People, showed up. Gut was in a kind of transition period between the Angels and the Pranksters. He had his old Hell's Angels sleeveless denim jacket on, but he had taken the insignia off, the lettering and the emblem of a skull with a helmet on, but you could see where it had all been because the denim was lighter underneath. It was what you might call a goodbye but not forgotten Hell's Angels jacket. Anyway, Gut amazed the Pranksters by painting a big, beautiful American eagle on the bus, a little primitive but strong. The big, hulking Jesus angel had talent. The Pranksters were all pleased as hell. They felt they had brought it out of him somehow. Gut got everybody revved up. They built a gun turret on the bus and rigged up two big gray cannons that you could maneuver. Norman made a machine gun out of wood and cardboard and painted it olive drab. Other people were knocking together wooden guns of various ridiculous descriptions. Faye's sewing machine was going. Pranksters, inner circle and outer circle, were driving in from all over. Lee Kornstrom, of the outer circle, showed up with a huge supply of army insignia, shoulder patches, arm patches, hash marks, bars, stars, epaulets. Kesey was rigging up the bus with tapes and microphones and amplifiers and earphones and electric guitars. Hagen was rigging up his 16mm camera and films. Bob Dylan and the Beatles and Joan Baez and Roland Kirk and Mississippi John Hunt were droning and clattering over the big speakers from over the way atop the dirt cliff. Then Allen Ginsberg turned up from Big Sur with his companion Peter Orlovsky and an entourage of pale Chester A. Arthur High School Hindus. Ginsberg sang mantras all night and jingled bells and finger cymbals. Cassidy hooked down speed and worked himself up from a standing start, jerking, kicking, dancing. He seemed to be moving in time to the sewing machine on a long seam. Ginsberg seemed to be chanting in time to a gynist's whisk broom. Cassidy began fibrillating the vocal cords, going faster and faster until by dawn, if he had gone any faster, he would have vibrated off, as old Charles Fort said, and gone instantly into the positive absolute. It was a nice, weird party. The next morning, October 16th, the big day. The Pranksters blew the morning naturally, all stroked out in various attitudes from the night before, and they were late getting off to Berkeley. Art is not eternal, friends. The plan was to meet the Hell's Angels in Palo Alto and go roaring down the freeway in formation. They put on Prankster tapes and Cassidy got in the driver's seat. Everybody climbed on in their crazed military costumes. Hassler, Hagen, Babs, Gretsch, Zonker, June the Goon, Roy Seaburn, Dale Kesey, and all sorts of people. Even the Mad Chemist. He showed up for this one, and Mary Microgram at the last minute. And then Kesey got on. Kesey was wearing a big orange coat of the sort highway workers wear so cars will see them. He had hash marks on the sleeves and some kind of floppy epaulets flapping on the shoulders. He had a big orange Day-Glow World War I helmet on his head. It was so big and came down so far over his forehead, his eyes were like two little flashlight bulbs under the lid. Kesey got up in the gun turret and they were off. Before they got to Palo Alto, in Woodside in fact, the cops stopped them and hassled them and checked them over. The Pranksters did the usual, leaped out with cameras and shotgun mics and tape recorders, filming and taping everything the cops said, and the cops left, but it ate up time. "Aha," said the Mad Chemist, "the first skirmish." "The Prankster alert is out," said Babs. That was just about right. They kept getting stopped and hassled and checked over and losing time. They got to the rendezvous in Palo Alto, and no Hell's Angels. They waited and waited for the Angels, then gave up and took off down the expressway to Berkeley. They didn't get to the Berkeley campus until almost dusk, and their arrival didn't make any very momentous impression at first. Now, a full phalanx of Hell's Angels, looking like a cross between the Gestapo and the Tonton Macoute, that would have been a different story, no doubt. Good and noisy, too. But as it was, the bus just pulled into the parking lot by the Student Union building, and the pranksters cut up as best they could, ack-acking their wooden guns at birds and planes. The big rally had been going on all day. They were out on a big lawn, or plaza, on the campus, about 15,000 of them, the toggle-coat bohemians, while the PA loudspeakers boomed and rattled and raked across them. There was a big platform set up for the speakers. There had been about 40 of them, all roaring or fulminating or arguing cogently, which was always worse. The idea at these things is to keep building up momentum and tension and suspense, until finally, when it is time for action, in this case, the march, the signal launches them as one great welded body of believers, and they are ready to march and take billy clubs upside the head and all the rest of it. All the shock workers of the tongue were there, speakers like Paul Jacobs and M.S. Arnone, who wore a prison uniform to the podium because his family had been wiped out in a German concentration camp during World War II. And out before them was a great sea of students and other youth, the toggle-coat bohemians, toggle-coats, desert boots, civil rights, down with the war in Vietnam. Could call out to you from their graves or from the fields and rivers upon which their ashes were thrown. They would implore this generation of Americans not to be silent in the face of the genocidal atrocities committed on the people of Vietnam. And the words rolled in full forensic boom over the PA systems. The first person in the Vietnam Day Committee circle to notice Kesey approaching the speaker's platform was Paul Krasner, the editor of The Realist magazine. Most of the pranksters were still on the bus, fooling around with the guns for the befuddlement of the gawkers who happened by. Kesey, Babs, Gretchen Fetchin, and George Walker came on over the platform, Kesey in his orange day-glow coat and World War I helmet. Krasner ran his magazine as pretty much a one-man operation, and he knew Kesey subscribed to it. So he wasn't so surprised that Kesey knew him. What got him was that Kesey just started talking to him, just like they had been having a conversation all along, and something had interrupted them, and now they were resuming. It is a weird thing. You feel the guy's charisma, to use that one, right away, busting out even through the nutty day glow, or maybe sucking one in, the way someone once wrote of Gurdjieff. You could not help being drawn almost physically towards him, like being sucked in by a vast spiritual vacuum cleaner. At the time, however, Krasner thought of Flash Gordon. "Look up there," Kesey says, motioning up toward the platform. Up there is Paul Jacobs. Jacobs tends toward the forensic anyway, and the microphone and loudspeakers do something to a speaker. You can hear your voice rolling and thundering, powerful as Votan, out over that ocean of big ears and eager faces, and you are omnipotent and more forensic and orotund and thunderous minute by minute. It is written, but I say unto you, the jackals of history, From where they are standing, off to the side of the platform, they can hear very little of what Jacobs is actually saying. But they can hear the sound barking and roaring and reverberating, and they can hear the crowd roaring back and baying on cue. And they can see Jacobs, hunched over squat and thick into the microphone, with his hands stabbing out for emphasis. And there, at sundown, silhouetted against the florid sky, is his jaw, jutting out like a cantaloupe. Kesey says to Krasner, "Don't listen to the words, just the sound and the gestures. Who do you see?" And suddenly Krasner wants very badly to be right. It is the call of the old charisma. He wants to come up with the right answer. "Mussolini?" Kesey starts nodding, "Right, right," but keeping his eye on the prognathous jaw. By this time, more of the pranksters have come up to the platform. They have found some electrical outlets, and they have run long cords up to the platform for the guitars and basses and horns. Kesey is the next to last speaker. He is to be followed by some final real barn burner of a speaker, and then the final surge and the march on Oakland. From the moment Kesey gets up there, it is a freaking jar. His jacket glows at dusk, and his helmet. Lined up behind him are more day-glow crazies, wearing aviator helmets and goggles and flight suits and army tunics, Babs, Gretch, Walker, Zonker, Mary Microgram, and the little day-glow kids, and half of them carrying electric guitars and horns, mugging and moving around in day-glow streaks. The next jar is Kesey's voice. It is so non-forensic. He comes on soft in the Oregon drawl like he's just having a conversation with 15,000 people. You know, you're not going to stop this war with this rally by marching. That's what they do. They hold rallies and they march. They've been having wars for 10,000 years, and you're not going to stop it this way. 10,000 years, and this is the game they play to do it. Holding rallies and having marches. And that's the same game you're playing. Their game. Whereupon he reaches into his great glowing day-glow coat and produces a harmonica and starts playing it right into the microphone. Home, home on the range. A wonking away on the goddamn thing. Home, home on the range. A wonk, a wonk. The crowd stands there in a sudden tender clump, most of them wondering if they heard right, cocking their heads and rolling their heads to one another. First of all, that conversational tone all of a sudden, and then random notes from the Dayglow crazies behind him ripped out often the electric guitars and the general babble of the place feeding into the microphone. Did anybody hear right? All the while, Kesey is still up there, honking away on the freaking harmonica. Home, home on the range. Ah, that's it. They figure it's some calculated piece of stage business playing home, home on the range, building up to something like, yeah, we know about that home. We know about that range. That rotten U.S. home and that rotten U.S. range. But instead it is the same down-home drawling voice. I was just looking at the speaker who was up here before me, and I couldn't hear what he was saying. But I could hear the sound of it, and I could hear your sound coming back at him, and I could see the gestures. And here Kesey starts parodying Paul Jacob's stabbing little hands and his hunched-over stance and his... And I could see his jaw sticking out like this, silhouetted against the sky. And you know who I saw? And who I heard? Mussolini. I saw and I heard Mussolini here just a few minutes ago. Yep. You're playing their game. Then he starts a-wonking away again, a-wonking and a-wonking home, home on the range with that sad old setter harmonica around the campfire pace, and the pranksters back him up on their instruments, Babs, Gretsch, George, Zonker, weaving up there in a great day-glow freakout. And what the hell? A few boos, but mainly confusion. What in the name of God are the ninnies? We've all heard all this and seen all this before, but we keep on doing it. I went to see the Beatles last month, and I heard 20,000 girls screaming together at the Beatles. And I couldn't hear what they were screaming either. But you don't have to. They're screaming, me, 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 I'm me. That's the cry of the ego, and that's the cry of this rally. Me, 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 me. And that's why wars get fought. Ego. Because enough people want to scream, pay attention to me. Yep, you're playing their game. And then more, wonka, 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 wonka. And the crowd starts going into a slump. It's as if the rally, the whole day, has been one long, careful inflation of a helium balloon preparing to take off. And suddenly somebody has pulled the plug. It's not what he is saying, either. It's the sound and the freaking sight and that goddamn mournful harmonica and that stupid Chinese music by the freak standing up behind him. It's the only thing the martial spirit can't stand, a put-on, a prank, a shuck, a goose in the anus. Vietnam Day Committee seethed together at the edge of the platform. Who the hell invited this bastard? You invited him. Well, hell, we figured he's a writer, so he'll be against the war. Didn't you have enough speakers? Says Krasner. You need all the big names you can get the crowd out. Well, that's what you get for being celebrity fuckers, says Krasner. If they had had one of those big hooks like they had on amateur night in the vaudeville days, they would have pulled Kesey off the podium right then. Well, then, why doesn't somebody just go up there and edge him off? He's ruining the goddamn thing. But then they see all the day-glow crazies, men and women and children all weaving and electrified, clawing at guitars, blowing horns, all crazed aglow at sundown. And the picture of the greatest anti-war rally in the history of America ending in a day-glow brawl to the tune of Home, Home on the Range. Suddenly, the honking on the freaking harmonica stops. Kesey leans into the microphone. There's only one thing to do. There's only one thing's gonna do any good at all. And that's everybody just look at it. Look at the war and turn your backs and say, fuck it. Wonka, 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 wonka. They hear that all right. The sound of the phrase, fuck it, sounds so weird, so shocking. Even here in Free Speech Citadel, just coming out that way over a public loudspeaker, rolling over the heads of 15,000 souls. Home, home on the range, wonka wonka wonka. And the prankster is beginning to build up most madly on their instruments now, behind the harmonica, sounding like an insane honky-tonk version of Juan Carrillo, who devised 96 tones on the back seat of a Willys Jeep, saved pennies all through the war to buy it, you understand, zinc pennies until the blue pustules formed under his zither finger nether there, you understand. Just look at it and turn away and say, fuck it. Say, fuck it. A wonka, 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 blam. Fuck it. A wonka, fuck it, friends. There was no way one could prove Kesey had done it. Nevertheless, something was gone out of the anti-war rally. The real barn burner spoke, and the Vietnam Day Committee tried to put in one last massive infusion of the old spirit, and then gave the signal, and the Great March on Oakland began through the gloaming. 15,000 souls, shoulder to shoulder like in the old strike posters. At the Oakland-Berkeley line, there was an arrow-shaped phalanx of police and National Guard. The Vietnam Day Committee marched in frantic clump at the head, trying to decide whether to force the issue, have a physical confrontation, heads busted, bayonets, or turn back when they ordered them to. Nobody seemed to have any resolve. Somebody would say, we have no choice, we've got to turn back, and somebody else would call him a Martin Luther King. That was about the worst thing you could call anybody on the New Left at that time. Martin Luther King turned back at the critical moment on the bridge at Selma. We can't risk submitting the crania of our devoted people to fracturization and degradation by those who do not shrink from a cowardly show of weaponry, he had said, going on like social science Negro in his sepulchral voice, the big solemn preachery Uncle Tom. Yeah, you Tuskegee-headed Uncle Tom, yeah. You Booker T. Washington peanut butter lecture podium Nobel Prize medalhead, you Uncle Tom. By the time it was all over, Martin Luther King was a stupid music hall handkerchief head on the New Left. And here they were, calling each other Martin Luther Kings and other incredible things, but nobody had any good smashing iron zeal to carry the day. Oh, where is our zealot, who dayglowed and fucked up our heads? And there was nothing to do but grouse at the National Guard and turn back, which they did. What the hell has happened to us? Who did this? Why, it was the masked man. So the huge march turned around and headed for Civic Center Park in Berkeley, and stood around there eating hamburgers and listening to music by a jug band, a group that later became known as Country Joe and the Fish, and wondering what the hell had happened. Then somebody started throwing tear gas from a rooftop, and Bob Scheer was bravely telling everybody to lie down on the grass because tear gas rises. But the jug band just stood there, petrified, with their hands and their instruments frozen in the same position as when the gas hit. It seems the jug band was high on something or other, and when the gas hit, the combination of the gas and whatever they were already up on, it petrified them, and they stood there in stark, stiff medias res, as if they were posing for an Iwo Jima sculpture for the biggest anti-war rally in the history of the American people. The whole rally now seemed like a big half-ass, with the frozen jug band the picture of how far they had gotten. Chapter 17. Departures. Prepare for Mexico. And then Kesey posted cryptic words on his Loghouse Prankster bulletin board. Let every thought, our whole direction, prepare for Mexico. Every morsel you eat, every book you read, every high, every low, every day-glow deed. But he never said why or when they might expect to go. Mountain Girl returns to Poughkeepsie. Now Mountain Girl groks fully of the prankster's psychic takeoff, and is the very radiometer of their super-psychic pace. No one ever plunged more fully in the psychedelic risk-all, or ever blazed more radiant through the splays of inner space. Yet not even a very Isis is immune against the crisis that swamps a woman's psyche when she is going to bear a child. It could never be easy to be 3,000 miles from Kesey, but she had to stop and try to grok more fully and go back east a while. Sandy returns to New York.
The path was soft as velvet, but Sandy heard it coming. Ahor, rising, materializing from the mists of his devotion. The demon's speed starts wrenching, leaves Sandy flinching in a bummer, dazed again in a half-crazed, demonic DMT implosion, causing psychosomatic, psychosidic cortical syndromes, even synarthrotic paralysis down the side of his lean face. He tries to cure himself, purify the psychic venom, but they're no use. All the prankster arts of this limelit magic place. Even I Ching says brain scans, EEGs, the whole clinical bit, which costs money. Keezy, let me pawn the Ampex, $400 tape machine. For after all, I brought it here in the first place. And then, stuck in his synarthrotic cortex, this thought. Keezy refused him the Ampex, prankster salvation machine. He goes back east for the clinical bit, but that won't be the end of it, Dream Warrior. Chapter 18. Cosmo's Tasmanian Deviltry. Can you pass the acid test? Comes the call chiseled on each prankster eyeball in Lincoln Gothic as we moan in this graveyard among moonstone tombstones with a philosophic, it's your ass. Can you pass the acid test? Babs and Keezy swaying in a California graveyard, baying deep in the sink, zonked on LSD on the brink, freaking steep of a missionary quest. Can you pass the acid test? Tombstones, vaults, coffins, and bald carbon-dated bones. A dream transfusion from the community breast. Can you pass the acid test? The group mind, flying high, Major, but not blind in the moonshine, was inspired with the ceremony that would be required in the moonshot to extend the prankster message to the ends of the earth. A mind fest. A moonship. The acid test. And Keezy emerged from the weird night in the graveyard with the vision of turning on the world, literally, and a weirdly practical way of doing it known as the acid test. For, as it has been written, he develops a strong urge to extend the message to all people. He develops a rites, often involving music, dance, liturgy, sacrifice, to achieve an objectified and stereotyped expression of the original, spontaneous religious experience. Christ, how many movements before them had run into this self-same problem? Every vision, every insight of the original circle always came out of the new experience, the Kairos. And how to tell it? How to get it across to the multitudes who had never had this experience themselves? You couldn't put it into words. You had to create conditions in which they would feel an approximation of that feeling, the sublime Kairos. You had to put them into ecstasy. Buddhist monks immersing themselves in cosmic love through fasting and contemplation. Hindus zonked out in bhakti, which is fervent love in the possession of God. Ecstatics flooding themselves with Krishna through sexual orgies or plunging into the dinners of the Bacchanalia. Christians off in Edge City through Gnostic Onanism or the heart of Jesus or the child Jesus with its running sore or the acid test. And suddenly Keezy sees that they, the pranksters, already have the expertise and the machinery to create a mind-blown state such as the world has never seen, totally wound up, lit up, amplified, and controlled. Plus the most efficient key ever devised to open the doors in the mind of the world, namely Owsley's LSD. For months, Keezy has been trying to work out the fantasy of the dome. This was going to be a great geodesic dome on top of a cylindrical shaft. It would look like a great mushroom, many levels. People would climb a stairway up the cylinder. Buy a ticket? Well. And the dome would have a great foam rubber floor they could lie down on. Sunk down in the foam rubber below floor level would be movie projectors, videotape projectors, light projectors. All over the place, up in the dome, everywhere, would be speakers, microphones, tape machines. Live, replay, variable lag. People could take LSD or speed or smoke grass and lie back and experience what they would, enclosed and submerged in a planet of lights and sounds such as the universe never knew. Lights, movies, videotapes, videotapes of themselves, flashing and swirling over the dome from the beams of searchlights rising from the floor from between their bodies. The sounds roiling around in the globe like a typhoon. Movies and tapes of the past,
tapes and videotapes, broadcasts and pictures of the present, tapes and humanoid sounds of the future, but all brought together now, here and now, Kairos, into the dilated cerebral cortex. The geodesic dome, of course, was Buckminster Fuller's inspiration. The light projections were chiefly Gerd Stern's, Gerd Stern of the USCO group, although Roy Seaburn had already done a lot with them, and Paige Browning showed a talent that surprised everybody. But the magic dome, the new planet, was Kesey and the Pranksters. The idea went beyond what would later be known as mixed media entertainment, now a standard practice in psychedelic discotheques and so forth. The Pranksters had the supramedium, a fourth dimension, acid, Cosmo, all one, control, the movie. But why a dome? The answer to all the prankster fantasies, public and private, the whole solution. They already found it. Namely, the Hell's Angels party. That two-day rout hadn't been a party, but a show. It had been more than a show, even. It had been an incredible concentration of energy. Not only the pranksters, but people from all over. Heads, non-heads, intellectuals, curiosity seekers, even cops, had turned up and gotten swept up in the incredible energy of the thing. They had been in the prankster movie. It was one show that hadn't been separated into entertainers and customers, with the customers buying a ticket and saying, "All right, now entertain me." At the Angels' party, everybody got high together, and everybody did his thing and entertained everybody else. Angels being angels, Ginsburg being Ginsburg, pranksters being pranksters, and cops being cops. Even the cops did their thing, splashing those big, lush, evil, revolving red turret lights off the dirt cliff, and growling and baying and hassling cars. Can you pass the acid test? Anybody who could take LSD for the first time and go through all that without freaking out. Leary and Alpert preached set and setting. Everything in taking LSD and having a fruitful, freak-out-free LSD experience depended on set and setting. You should take it in some serene and attractive setting, a house or apartment decorated with objects of the honest sort. Turkoman tapestries, Greek goatskin rugs, cost-plus blue jugs, soft lights. Not Japanese paper globe lights, however, but untasselated Chinese textile shades. In short, an uptown bohemian country retreat of the $60,000-a-year sort, ideally, with Mozart's Requiem issuing with liturgical solemnity from the hi-fi. The set was the set of your mind. You should prepare for the experience by meditating upon the state of your being and deciding what you hope to discover or achieve on this voyage into the self. You should also have a guide who has taken LSD himself and is familiar with the various stages of the experience and whom you know and trust. And fuck that. That only clamped the constipation of the past, the eternal lags, on something that should happen now. Let the setting be as unserene and lurid as the prankster arts can make it, and let your set be only what is on your brain, man, and let your guide, your trusty hand-holding, head-swaddling guide, be a bunch of day-glow crazies who have as one of their mottos, "Never trust a prankster." The acid tests would be like the Angels' party plus all the ideas that had gone into the dome fantasy. Everybody would take acid any time they wanted, 6 hours before the test began or the moment they got there, at whatever point in the trip they wanted to enter the new planet. In any event, they would be on a new planet. The mysteries of the sink. Very strange. The acid tests turned out, in fact, to be an art form foreseen in that strange book, Childhood's End, a form called Total Identification. The history of the cinema gave the clue to their actions. First sound, then color, then stereoscopy, then cinerama, had made the old moving pictures more and more like reality itself. Where was the end of the story? Surely the final stage would be reached when the audience forgot it was an audience and became part of the action. To achieve this would involve stimulation of all the senses and perhaps hypnosis as well. When the goal was attained, there would be an enormous enrichment of human experience.